today as a key around here in school and also all across the world. We are commemorating the efforts and the sacrifices and the selflessness and the incredible achievements that have come at the expense of many lives in Zahal. In Yom HaZikaron, we look for ways to build those connections to individuals and even more so to the entire amazing achievement of Medina Israel. We're privileged today to welcome Rabbi Brander, who's the Dean of the Center for Jewish Future, Yeshiva University, who has built communities that he doesn't even know of, not even the communities that people list on his impressive resume, having founded a yeshiva and a community and a kollel in Boca Raton, Florida, but as the inspiration for hundreds of students all across the world at all different age levels and different generations. Rabbi Brander is a voice of modern orthodoxy and Yeshiva University and of Torah learning in a way that asks us to take responsibility, in a way that tells us that what we learn must have legs, it must live. When we think, we always need to ask a question, and what does this mean for us? How do we connect? Rabbi Brander, thank you so much for joining us today. The mikvot are being passed out. As Rabbi Brander speaks to us, we have an opportunity to really dig in, to learn together about the incredible sacrifices and the incredible mitzvah and zchut of Medina Israel. Please join me in welcoming Rabbi Brander.
Good morning. It's really a privilege to be here and share words of Torah with you. With the permission of your wonderful head of school and all the other wonderful role models that you have here, Torah scholars, both men and women, I'd like to be able to share words of Torah with you. And I'd like to introduce these words of Torah with my own personal story connected to the wonderful words that were said before about the Shalit family. When I finished high school, I had the privilege of studying in Shalavim. It's one of the Hezer Yeshivot, now actually more popular than it was then. It was a smaller yeshiva with a little less Americans. We roomed two Israelis and two Americans in each room. And each one of us was assigned an older chavruta, an older study partner, someone who was in their final years of the Hezder program, a five-year program, and we were all assigned like a fourth or fifth year young man to study with us. I was assigned a person who had recently got married, was living at the yeshiva, and he was the librarian. So we would actually learn night seder, not in the Beit Midrash, but in the library. And we learned for a year together. And there, he shared with me some of the ideas that I'm going to share with you now. You see, for the most part, we think about our connection to Medina Israel, to the state of Israel, the land of Israel, and we believe in our responsibility to celebrate the beginning of the Medina, the beginning of the flourishing of the final redemption of the Jewish people. But it's important, especially because if you're not challenging yourself about this issue, hopefully you will be challenged by yourself or by others on the issue of why is it appropriate, or how can we suggest that this Medina represents the beginning of the redemptive process. After all, the people who started the Medina were not all Shomer Shabbat. Many of them didn't even eat kosher. Now, how could it be that this is the beginning of the final redemption of the Jewish people? We all know of the challenges that the state of Israel is going through, whether it is with the Arab communities, both in Israel and the countries around it. We know the challenges that there is in Israel with what we call Chozer B'Sheilah, and that is young men and young women who are not only returning to Judaism, but some who are moving away from Judaism, the same challenges that we have in the diaspora. And this chavruta of mine shared with me a sefer that was not yet in print, that had been written, called Eim Habanim Smecha. By a show of hands, how many people are aware of that sefer? Okay, that's great. So this sefer of Eim Habanim Smecha... Oh, wow. So this sefer of Eim Habanim Smecha, written by Rav Tachtal, who I'm not going to speak much about now, for a while, for family reasons, was not in print. But my chavruta, who was a librarian, went to Hebrew University, made a copy of it, two copies, one for himself, one for me, and we studied it together. In the first Lebanon War, my chavruta, as well as many from Yeshiva, from the Hesder program, were fighting in the war. His wife was pregnant at the time, and my chavruta, Shlomo Uman, passed away, was killed in that war. And for me, it was perhaps the first time, it was the first year that I was at Yeshiva University, it was for me the first time that I had known someone in a very, very strong and serious way who had given up their life and had such a bright future, was about to go to law school, was a serious Talmud Chacham, had given up his life in order to protect Medina Israel. His wife gave birth to a baby boy that unfortunately needed to be named after his father, who he had never met. And shortly afterwards, the sefer came out in full print, and a few of us dedicated many copies of that sefer of Eim Habanim Smecha in his memory to the yeshiva. But I think it is important for us to not only connect to Medina Israel from an emotional perspective, but to ask ourselves, why are there people like the Shalits, who, by the way, have a daughter who by Israeli law does not need to go into the army, but they decided that she would go into the army nevertheless because of their responsibility to Medina Israel? Why are there families like the Umans who are willing to sacrifice on behalf of Medina Israel? Where are the roots within our halakha, within Jewish philosophy? And how should we carry that off in conversations around our Shabbos table, in conversations with our friends and relatives who may be observant, who may keep all the mitzvot, but unfortunately do not understand the centrality of the not only the land of Israel, but the state of Israel to the Jewish Weltanschauung, to the Jewish outlook on life. So let's look at our sources together. Can everyone hear me? Can you hear me in the back? Can you hear me in the back? Yes. Okay. So let's look at these sources. The first source is a Midrash, which tells us that the Jewish people will go through three types of redemptive processes. The first one will be what we call the Gula from Mitzrayim. The second one will be a gula that will happen after the destruction of the first temple and the building of the second temple. Then the third redemption, which will come after the destruction of the second temple, thousands of years later. The third gula, we're told the following, Shlishit, the last words on source number one, Ein la hefseh. Once the Jewish people come back to the land of Israel for the third time, that will never be interrupted. In fact, in the Torah portions that we're going to read next week, Luchotai, we're introduced to the idea of the Tokacha, which I know you're all familiar with. But even within the Tokacha,
It speaks about the curses to the Jewish people. There are certain secrets in there that really give us a glimmer into the redemption. One of those secrets is something that the Ramban points out in source number 2, where it speaks about the fact that the land of Israel will be shmama, will be totally desolate, that our enemies will totally destroy the land of Israel. And the Ramban says that while it is essentially a curse that the land of Israel will be destroyed, that there will not be the opportunity for their people to grow food there. And indeed, when the Ottoman Turks were in charge of the land of Israel, they needed to import food. When the British were in charge of the land of Israel, they needed to import food. But the Ramban says, this curse is actually a blessing, because we will know when the redemption will happen, when the land is no longer desolate, when the land will no longer be a land of famine, but will be a land in which it is possible for it to feed its inhabitants. And more than that, a land that will actually be able to export food. So the Ramban tells us, in source number 2, I've extended the Rambam slightly, but the Ramban says, second line on source number 2, second word, V'gamzu ra'ayad gedola v'hakacha lanu lo timsa b'chol yishuv ha'aretz asher hi tova ruchava v'asher haitano shevet na'ola v'hi charva kamoa ki me'az yatz'anu mimena lo kikla u'ma v'lashom. Once we've left it, the land has not allowed its fruit to yield its fruit. Only when we come back, when there will no longer be in a state of galut, then we know that the redemption has happened. In fact, that's what the Gemara says in Sanhedrin. The Gemara says, do you want to know when the redemption will happen? The first words of source number 3, Amar Rebbe Abba. Rebbe Abba says, there's no clearer indication that the end, that the diaspora, that the galut is ending, than the fact that the land of Israel will begin to yield its fruits. It says, Rashi, Megula, Mizah, Keshi, Titain, Eretz, Yisrael, Piria, Be'ain, or Ba'ayin, Yafet, Azhi, Kare, Hakeit. When the land of Israel will not only yield fruit, but yield fruit in an abundant fashion, where oranges will be the size of grapefruits, then we know that the beginning of the redemption has happened. Here we have statements from the Gemara that speak to us about signs, external signs, about the redemptive process. Source number 4 highlights that same type of external sign. And source number 5, on the next page of the handout, lest we say, well, you know, if it's redemption, the Shiach needs to come, and the whole thing needs to change right away. But source number 5 teaches us something interesting. Can someone tell me what source number 5 teaches us? Just look at source number 5. No one raises their hand, I'm going to call on someone. So save your friends any form of embarrassment. The Hebrew and English... Oh, there's no Hebrew there. There's no English there. Okay, don't worry, it's not hard Hebrew. Okay? Tell me, what does it say? Source number 5. Anyone? What? Come on, someone. Take a stab at it. Yes. The Geula will come little by little. And the Gemara uses a similar example. Wonderful. What's your name? Yali. Very good. Thank you. Yali says that the Gemara says that just like the sun comes up slowly, kimat, kimat, you don't see the sun in one fell swoop, it comes up slowly, so too with the redemptive process. It happens in a slow fashion. The Gemara in Sanhedrin asks the question, but there's a stira, there's a contradiction, because there are some psukim that say that the Mashiach will come right away, fast, and there are some psukim that say, like an aniv or a chayv al chamor, that it will come slowly, like a poor person walking or riding upon a donkey. Or that there is a pasuk that says, Be'ita akishena, that redemption will happen in its right time, or akishena, it will be hastened. So the Gemara says there's no stira. It represents two paradigms to the redemptive process. Can someone tell me what they think those two paradigms are? We're good with the word paradigm, right? We're not? So that's a keyword. Two different experiences, two different dimensions, or not dimensions, two different types of redemptions that can happen. Two different types of redemptions that can happen. Yes?
So at first, like, they'll go to school, do, like, the whole process, and then afterwards, they'll get a study, and then they'll get a study on redemption.
Okay, your name?
Talia.
Talia? Good answer. Not the answer the Gemara gives, but a good answer. Good answer, though. Yes? What's your name?
Esti.
Great answer. Not the answer the Gemara gives, but correct. Talia and Esti, great answers. Yes, in the back there. What's your name? Michal. Stand up, I can't hear you. Wonderful, Michal. And that is that the redemption, says the Gemara. Redemption can happen two different ways. It can happen, there are two paradigms through which, and if you don't learn any of the Torah, at least you'll get that SAT word right. There are two paradigms of redemption. One is it can happen right away. And another way it can happen slowly. Because sometimes the Jewish people need redemption even if they don't deserve it. Redemption and tshuva are important connections, but they're not a necessary pro quo, quid pro quo. In other words, you don't always need redemption in order for the Jewish people to be redeemed.
Look at source number 7, where the Ramban says to us, in the second paragraph of that Ramban, V'hinei ein b'shira hazot t'nai b'tshuva v'avodah. There is no statement when we speak about the redemption in Parshat Hazinu that there needs to be guaranteed repentance in order to bring tshuva. HaKadosh Baruch Hu can decide that the Jewish people need gula, need redemption, even if not everybody involved in the process is observant. HaKadosh Baruch Hu can use anybody that He wants to bring the redemption process. In fact, the Or HaChaim on the Parshiot that we are reading now takes a scenario that speaks about an individual who's going through a difficult time. Ki yamuch achicha, if your brother is downtrodden, if your brother is having a difficult time, if your brother or sister has no money, who is supposed to help the brother and sister first? Their family, the close relatives. But what happens? What happens if there's no one to help the brother and sister in the family? So then what happens is it's the responsibility of all the Jewish people to help this person. Says the Or HaChaim in source number 8 the following, and you can look at these sources inside, you can study them with your teachers. We don't have time to read them all inside, but this is a very powerful source. A very powerful source. Michal, you with me in the back there? Yeah. You good? Okay. Source number 8. Talia, you with me? Good. Source number 8. Here's what source number 8 says. And that is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to turn to the Gedolim, to the great leaders of the Jewish people, when He needs them to redeem the Jewish people. And some Gedolim will respond, and some will not. And by the way, this is exactly what is discussed in Eim HaBalim Smecha. And then HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to turn, not to the members of His immediate family to redeem the Jewish people, but He's going to turn to people who may not be totally observant, who may not be totally Shomer Torah Mitzvot, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to ask them to redeem the Jewish people. Because if you look at the last words of source number 8, Ki Keitz HaGalut Yeshno, because there is the opportunity for there to be the end of the Galut, Afilu Yisrael Rishayim Gemurim Chas V'Shalom. even if the Jewish people are totally wicked, God forbid. In other words, there are two points here. Point number one is that redemption can happen whether the Jewish people have done tshuva or not. And point number two is that who HaKadosh Baruch Hu uses as a shliach, as a messenger, is not for us to decide. In fact, look at the next source. The next source talks about four lepers. Does anyone know who those four lepers are, the Arba Metzorayim? Come on, it's Tanakh. It's Tanakh. I tell the students at Yeshiva University, it's bad enough you don't know the sources in the Talmud, but the sources in Tanakh we should know. The four lepers, who are they? Knew anybody? Ladies, come on, speak up. Anyone want to take a guess? Four people who are in the process of having leprosy during this storyline. Not Miriam. It's a Malachim. She's dead by Malachim. At least in the physical sense. Anybody? Text a friend. You need a lifeline. No. And his sons. Very good, Rabbi Weissman and what? Oh, Rabbi Tefta, excuse me. Tell me a little bit about Gehazi. Who was Gehazi's response? Who was Gehazi? What was Gehazi's job? You know? What was Gehazi's job? Shh. It was more than Elisha's student. He was Elisha's shamish. He was in charge. Ladies, you with me? He was in charge of making sure that anybody who wanted to meet with Elisha the prophet had to go through Gehazi in order to meet with Elisha the prophet. It's a very, very unbelievable job and a very difficult job. And Gehazi, at one point in time, Elisha heals a foreign general from leprosy. The foreign general, well, I'm not going to ask you the name, the foreign general agrees to pay Elisha. Elisha says, I don't want your money. Similar to what Abraham does. Gehazi sees that there's so much money here. Gehazi follows the foreign general and says, you know, my boss, Elisha, he's changed his mind. He has salaries to pay. He has things to do. He'll take the money. And Naaman gives him the money. And Elisha realizes that Gehazi has created this terrible Chilul Hashem. I mean, can you imagine the assistant to the Gadol Hador abusing his power? What a Chilul Hashem. And he is banished from the people of Israel, and he gets with his children who are part of the plan. They all get leprosy, the exact plague that Elisha had healed this foreign general from. Now the Jewish people are surrounded by an enemy, and the Jewish people are about to be destroyed. They have no food. They have no army left to fight. And Gehazi and his three sons, these four lepers, they're living outside the town. So if there's no food in the town, there's no food outside the town. So they decide that they're going to surrender to the enemies of the Jewish people. They say, listen, what's the best case scenario? Either they'll kill us right away, that's better than starving to death, or they'll give us food. Either way, let's surrender. They surrender, and they go to the camp of the enemies, and they see that all the enemies miraculously left. And they see that the whole camp is still there. There's all this food. There's all this gold. And they have two choices now. They can keep it all for themselves, or they can go back to the Jewish people who threw them out and say that they can be redeemed. So they decide to go back to the Jewish people and tell them, listen, our enemies have left. It's safe to leave the city. No one's going to kill us. Now, the Jewish people don't believe these guys for obvious reasons that we don't even have to state. But they have no choice, and they send out a small search party. And they find out that Gehazi is right. Says Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, Zatzal, if God can use the four lepers, a person who is the assistant to the Gadol Hador, and in front of the world, embarrassed the greatest leader of the Jewish people at that time, if God could use that person to save the Jewish people, don't you think that people like Ben-Gurion, who were nowhere near, who weren't bad people, they never did anything inappropriate. They may not have kept Shabbat, they may not have eaten kosher, but they cared for the Jewish people, they cared for the immortality of the Jewish people. If God can use four lepers to save the Jewish people in Malachim, can't God use non-observant Jews who care so much for the Jewish people? Can't God use anybody that He wants? God forbid, I'm not suggesting in any way that Ben-Gurion is anywhere near as bad as those four lepers. My point is that if God can use wicked people, then He can use anyone, even people who are not outwardly observant or outwardly engaged in a relationship with God. And that idea is highlighted in Source 9. And that idea is highlighted in Source 9-8. And Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer, who tries to buy back the makom of the Beit HaMikdash because it was for sale, because the Egyptian government didn't have any money, and they wanted to sell the Temple Mount, and he went to Baron Rothschild to try to get money for it. He didn't get the money for it. He writes this unbelievable statement in Source number 10. He speaks about the fact that redemption does not happen in one fell swoop, but the responsibility of redemption, happens when we engage in the process. I'd like to read this to you just for a minute. Gulat, by the way, does anyone know of a very famous place that's named after Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer? There's a place named after him. It has the word Tzvi in it.
Kiryat Tzvi.
Kiryat Tzvi. Very good. Kiryat Tzvi. Named after Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer. Gula Yisrael. The redemption of the Jewish people. U'Mashiach Tzikenu. And the bringing of Mashiach. Asher anachnu chokim lo kol hayom, that we wait for and that we pray for every day. Al yachshov hachoshev ki pitaom yarat Hashem yitbarach shemo mishamayim baretz. Don't think that God's going to come down one day and announce that Mashiach's here. Le'mor la'amot, say, go, yishlach Mashiach pitaom min hashamayim. Don't think that that's what's going to happen. Next paragraph. Lo kein, that's not the way it's going to go. What's going to happen is, look at the last paragraph, source number 10. Reshit Hagula Tia Ayde Sibati Vit Mibnei Adam. It's only going to be when the Jewish people are willing to take the first steps. Only then. Vayde Ratzon HaMalchiyot. And only when the nations of the world are going to allow the Jewish people to return to the land of Israel. And so the point that I'm trying to make to you is, number one, let's summarize our points. Number one, are there external signs in the Torah for redemption? Are there external signs in the Torah for redemption?
Yes.
What are they? You can yell them out. What are they?
The land will be fruitful.
Tell me in the back, over there.
the one talking to your friend. What other external? What other external signs are there about the land of Israel? You know? What other external signs? Any? You know? Not lepers. The fact that the land will show its fruit. Does redemption happen in one moment? Or does redemption happen slowly? It can happen slowly. And does redemption have to begin by the great scholars of our generation? Or can any Jew or any person be involved in redemption? How do you know that? Right, very good. Very good. So along comes a Gemara in source number 13. Along comes a Gemara number source number 13. Here's what the Gemara says. And this is our final point. Gimel Shvuot Halalu. There are three oaths that God was engaged in when the Jewish people were kicked out of the land of Israel. What are they? Achat. Shelo Ya'alu Yisrael B'choma. One. The Jewish people are not allowed to return to Israel en masse. The Jewish people are forbidden to return to Israel en masse. Va'achat, shehashpia HaKadosh Baruch Hu et Yisrael, shelo yimrodu or yimrodu b'umot ha'olam. That the Jewish people will not return to Israel and rebel against the nations of the world. Va'achat, and the final oath, shehashpia HaKadosh Baruch Hu es odei kichavim, shelo yishtavru behem Yisrael yoter midai. And the third one is that God made the nations of the world swear that they would not oppress the Jewish people too much. So here are three oaths. Oath number one, the Jewish people will not return en masse to Israel. Oath number two, the Jewish people will not rebel against the nations of the world in order to go to Israel. And oath number three, the nations of the world will not rebel against the nations of the world will not persecute the Jewish people too much. Every single time you march, ladies, every single time you march in the Israeli Gay Parade, you'll go past a group of Jews called the Neturei Karta, who are the fringe of a larger group of the Safar community, who are serious Jewish people, serious Torah observer Jews. We can all eat in their homes. And they ask the following question to each and every one of you. How can you march in the Israeli Day Parade, the government of Israel, and the whole state of Israel, is against a Gemara that I just read to you? A Gemara that says that the Jewish people cannot return to Israel en masse. A Gemara that says that the Jewish people cannot engage in fighting, in warfare, against the nations of the world. And so how is it possible that each and every one of you has the right to march in an Israeli Day Parade if you're truly observant Jews? Who will give you the right to say Hallel tomorrow? If you're truly observant Jews, you should be saying Tachnun tomorrow. You're violating the Gemara, a Mefurish and Gemara in Ketubot, that says that the Jewish people are not allowed to return to the land of Israel in one fell swoop and not to rebel against the nations of the world. Answer the question.
This is the Gemara of the three promises of the Jewish.
So,
one answer is. They look at these three oaths. They are what's called perhaps a Tanai Kuffel, a conditional oath. And that is that the Jewish people are not allowed to return to Israel en masse or rebel against the nations of the world only if we're not persecuted too much. Well, let me ask you a question. Do you think the Crusades fulfilled that? Do you think the Crusades filled that already? That's probably yes. And if anybody thinks that the Crusades wasn't strong enough, I think it's fair to say that the Holocaust was. Any other answers? Yes? It's okay. Cheating is allowed for the next 10 minutes.
It's not regarding returning to Israel. It's just regarding rebuilding the Amidah.
Most commentaries say, and that's why no halachic commentator like the Shulchan Aruch or the Rambam or others, what we call Rishonim, well, the Shulchan Aruch is not a Rishon, but the Rishonim that are poskim of halacha list this as a halachic issue is because it's about rebuilding the Beis HaMikdash. Any other answers? Yes? Yes?
Okay, so maybe you could say that the guidelines are a little bit vague in the sense that we didn't, you could say we went back on mass, but there were Jews living there for thousands of years and we're still not all back.
Yeah, but it's not the same as, first of all, the vast majority of Jews are probably living in Israel than the diaspora now. That's number one. Secondly, and that is, we now have a formal state. In the past, they were living there, but they weren't a formal state. So we don't have a problem with Jews living in Israel, says the Samer, says the great Rebbe, the great Samer Rebbe, who each and every one of us has a responsibility to respect, even if we disagree with. So that doesn't work, because they say, okay, let's just get rid of the state of Israel, let's let the Palestinians run the government, and then we'll march in the Palestinian Day Parade. So any other answers? There are two good ones already. Number one, it's a conditional oath, and the oath hasn't been honored by one side, therefore it doesn't have to be honored. Number two is, and that is, it only refers to one issue, and that is the issue of rebuilding the Beit HaMikdash. Any other answers? The first answer, I think, is the best. Yes, all the way in the back. So you're answering, if the redemption process happens slowly, so how can these Gemaras work? That's a great answer. And that's why the Rambam and others say that these Gemaras are not halakhic Gemaras. They are a ganita that you're supposed to learn lessons from, but not halakha from. But there's one more answer that I'm looking for. Yes?
The Jews aren't rebelling.
Why aren't they rebelling?
Because if they were rebelling, they wouldn't be holding back, killing all the Palestinians they killed and were captured, and you can't consider them doing that.
Okay, there should be another reason why they're not considered rebelling, besides the reason you just gave. Yes? Besides that reason. Oh, great answer. There's one more reason. The UN, and before that, the San Remo Conference, both voted that the Jews have a right to a homeland. And therefore, it's not considered violating the oath. So it's important, I share these with you because it's important for you to realize this is, and I'm not trying, it's intellectually dishonest for me to suggest that in 5 minutes we're going to go through the approach of a great rabbi, but this is the kernel of the approach. This is the strongest piece, this Gemara, and I wanted you to come up with the answers, which you did so beautifully, of why this Gemara no longer applies, assuming it ever had a halachic stance, because this is probably what we call a ganita, which does not have halachic legs to it. Rabbi Soloveitchik in the 1950s put together a beautiful lecture that he gave for a few hours called Kododi Dofik. It speaks about the knocks of God, that God is knocking on his lover, and God's lover is the Jewish people, wanting there to be a relationship. And Rabbi Soloveitchik explains And we don't have time to go through it all, but it's here for your perusal, for you to read. If we can turn to page 7, he speaks about the six knocks. I'm just going to mention the six knocks, the six things that happen with the state of Israel. That each and every one of us needs to be sensitive to. The first is the fact that for the first time in the political arena that there was an establishment of the state of Israel. Rabbi Soloveitchik writes something that he wrote in the 1950s, but I think it's still true in 2011. He says that he thinks that this is probably the only meaningful thing that the United Nations had done until 1957 or so, or until 1948, was the establishment of the State of Israel. He's not convinced that they'll do anything meaningful afterwards. Unfortunately, his prophecy has come true. The second knock is the fact of the miracle of a small Israeli defense force surrounded by so many large armies, and the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has given us the strength with all the challenges to resist the enemies around us. And the third knot is the fact that for so many generations, the Catholic community stated that the reason why the Jewish people are wandering people, are wandering Jews, is because they didn't embrace the true God of the world. And now all of Catholic doctrine on this issue has to be redone now that the Jewish people have their own state. The fourth knock is a knock that you all understand. The fact that young people will go to Israel and find a spirituality that they can't find anywhere else. Young people who have a Torah observant background and young people who do not yet have a Torah observant background will find that. The fifth knock is the knock that Rabbi Soloveitchik speaks about Jewish blood never being hefker, never being taken for granted anymore. And Rabbi Soloveitchik continues, and he ends this piece with the following idea. He ends it like this, in the 1950s, and I think it still applies now. Too often, Orthodox Torah Jews can always look at the state of Israel and say what's wrong. It isn't religious enough, it isn't perfect this way, not every single thing keeps Shabbos, not every single part of the Medina is the way we want it, and we have become experts in figuring out what's wrong and not being engaged within the process. Each and every one of us has to realize the following. That as Jews who live in this generation, we have the opportunity to do something that our great-grandparents had never even dreamed of. And that is the fact that the Jewish people would have a homeland. The Jewish people would have a state. I want to conclude with two stories. The first is a story that has to do with the Israeli government that I think speaks volumes to each and every one of us. When I was in Yeshiva University as a rabbinical student, the Soviet Union was still in existence. It was a communist country. It was forbidden for Jews to learn in the Soviet Union. And the Israeli government used to ask Rabbi Soloveitchik on a regular basis about sending his students into the Soviet Union to teach Torah. At one point, Rabbi Soloveitchik suggested that the Israeli government send me to the Soviet Union. And so for 6 months, I learned how to read Russian. I was taught how to deal with the KGB on Sundays. The Israeli government would teach me in case something would happen about how to deal with the KGB. I was taught, for example, that when I would leave my suitcases in my room, I was taught simple things like after I zippered my suitcases,
I would take powder and put it around the zipper so that if my suitcases were opened, there would be powder dust on the floor right near my suitcases. I was taught how to bribe in effective ways, not by giving money, but giving jeans and cigarettes and alcohol and other things. I was taught how to call Soviet dissidents by taking dimes that were the same size of tokens in Russia to use public payphones, except the dimes needed, the edges of the dimes needed to be sanded down so that they would work, and the Israeli government gave me rolls of pre-sanded down dimes. And I was given responsibilities in three different cities. In Moscow, and then what was called Leningrad, and in Tallinn, Estonia. And in Tallinn, Estonia, I was thrown out of the Soviet Union by the KGB for reasons we won't discuss. The bottom line is that everywhere you go in any dangerous part of the world for Jews, there's one government that is making sure that those Jews are taken care of. And that is the State of Israel. Whether it was 20 years ago, or whether it is Jews now in Turkey or in other places in the world, or Ethiopia, there's only one state whose mandate and mission is to make sure that Jews are safe around the world, and that's the State of Israel. Story number two, and with this we conclude. Before I had the privilege of coming to Yeshiva University, I had the privilege of being a rabbi in a community called Boca Raton. And one time, before Pesach, the assistant rabbi of the synagogue comes to me with a terrible story. His cousin, was a young boy with various different physical and mental challenges, was waiting at a bus stop in Israel for his special bus, and a bomb went off, and he was killed. He came to me and he said, "I want to do something for this nefesh, for this soul that was lost." I told him, "Go back to your parents for Pesach, pick off Pesach, think about what you want to do, and then we'll talk about it after you deal with the tragedy a little bit. You'll come back." He comes back after Pesach with a plan. He says, "You know what I'm going to do? For every soul that was blown up in Israel, I'm going to put a soul in Israel. I'm going to create an organization called Nefesh Tachat Nefesh," which became Nefesh the Nefesh. The first 6 months, Rabbi Fass, as the assistant rabbi of the Boca Raton Synagogue, basically no longer had jobs as the assistant rabbi, but the shul gave him the opportunity, the financial opportunity, to develop his idea. I get a phone call from the FBI. The FBI wants to let us know that the Boca Raton Synagogue, the synagogue that no one has ever heard of, now is on a terrorist watch list, and that every single morning there will be dogs that will come to sniff out if there are any bombs before Shacharis and after Maariv. If anyone's ever been to the Boca Raton Synagogue, you'll see there's a big, large fence around it. That's the reason for the fence. And if you look very carefully, behind the fence, there are cement holes filled with cement. You can't see them because they're painted the same color, to make sure that no cars can drive in there and blow up the synagogue. Why did it deserve this honorable mention? Because of the fact that its assistant rabbi started an organization to bring Jews to Israel. You see, the Palestinians understood something that sometimes we don't understand. The Arabs realized something that I didn't recognize myself. that a shul that's going to advocate for Jews to move to Israel is a movement that will destroy the fact that maybe Israel won't last. A shul that will advocate for Jews to move to Israel is a shul that is advocating a person like Rabbi Fast, who's going to create an easy way to move to Israel, might actually make sure that the dream of a state of Israel will last forever, and that we can't have. We sometimes should learn from the Palestinians, or from the terrorists. Not every Palestinian is a terrorist. We sometimes should learn from the terrorists about what our responsibilities are, and to recognize that both physically and spiritually, there's no stronger place that guarantees the future of the Jewish people than Medina Israel, and also to recognize something that sometimes needs to be told to us, the responsibility to realize that without the state of Israel, our existence in New York is in peril, and the existence of Jews around the world is in crisis. And we learned from the sources today, redemption can happen slowly, the signs of redemption are there, God can take anyone he wants for redemption, and whatever challenging Gemara there may be to the state of Israel, you've answered why that's no longer a challenge. If we take those ideas and put them into our hearts and our minds, that will help guarantee the future of the state of Israel and the future of our people, and we will help bring Mashiach, not by singing we want Mashiach now, but by doing something perhaps a little bit more importantly, that is acting on the messages of that song. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rabbi Brander. Girls. Today we take the moments, not just in learning. Thank you for the messages of inspiring us to think about the values of Medina Israel. I'm going to just conclude it with this anecdote that Mrs. Tiger shared with me actually this morning of what the Rav said with regard to the flag, Dagli Israel. The Rav said that when you look at the blue and white of the flag, many people say, you know, well, that's a very secular notion, to have a flag, to have an icon, to have a symbol. We don't have those in Judaism. But the Degel of Medina Yisrael takes on a level of Kedushah because it actually is like the tachrichim, like the shrouds that people are buried in. Every single nefesh that sacrificed itself for the Medina is represented in the Degel. We look at the blue and the white, and it has in it those nefeshot. And as we stand singing, davening, even just envisioning our own potential future in Eretz Yisrael, we need to recognize how many nefeshot have been laid down for that privilege. Today we memorialize and tomorrow we celebrate. Today we make it a commitment to always honor those who dedicated themselves to the establishment of the Medina, and tomorrow, Mitzvah Hashem, we have the privilege to really, every single one of us, celebrate and dance and envision ourselves as a part of the Medina as well. Thank you, Robert Brander, for enriching our day. Please continue on to your third period. It's our first period classes. There is no second period today. My mistake, okay?
Okay, girls, before you get up, just wait 1 second. Bye. Girls, wait. Sit for 1 minute. Please sit. Okay, my fourth period, ninth grade, we'll be having lunch, fourth period, fifth period, come to the classroom of 203 for a special speaker. And Mrs. Katz's 12th grade current issues class, fourth period, instead of going to your normal classroom, come to room 203, also for the special speaker. Thank you very much. Go to class.
Ladies, hold on to your girls. They are shameful.